Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 6 years of law enforcement analysis experience with the Portland Police Bureau and 10 years of data analysis overall. He holds a master's in forensic psychology from Marymount University in Virginia, here to talk about, among other things, strategic analysis and working from home. Please welcome Cody Gabbard. Cody, how are we doing?
Good, Jason. How are you doing?
I am doing very well. How is Northwestern United States?
The best. It's the best coast.
Doing well, hanging in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Spring is starting to peak out. So yeah, things are good in Portland.
All right. Very good. So how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
That is a bit of a journey. I always wanted to get into law enforcement from kind of the jump. Back when I was in school, I didn't necessarily train for it. My undergrad is in accounting, but I did an internship. A good friend of mine, actually our neighbors, worked at a federal probation office, and he got me an internship. It was after my freshman year, my first freshman year of college, and just the environment was great. I got to be in federal courthouse every day. This was in Northern Kentucky in Covington. So that kind of wet my beak, I guess, a little bit. It mm-hmm. got me excited. And I kind of knew that I wanted to be in this arena, but I didn't know how I fit. You know, I always thought it would be maybe in investigations, maybe in the actual like law enforcement. But fast forward to, like, was it maybe 2010? And I got my first job out of grad school with the National Insurance Crime Bureau. And then I'm sure we'll get into it, but I bounced around in the private sector after that. And then finally ended up here. This is like my first true, I guess, law enforcement paid job.
So you went into graduate school right out of undergrad, or?
I didn't. And that was mm-hmm. part of it. So my undergrad was in accounting. Mm-hmm. Just because it was one of those things where it was the first class I took that I did well in. I was like, all right, I guess this is what I'm doing. But I kind of hated it. And I think I was maybe the first person in my major to actually see their grades go down each year. Man. But I did well in all my other classes. I didn't enjoy it, and it reflected that. And I was actually a financial advisor out of mm-hmm. college. And after 10 months, I'd had enough and realized that if I wanted to do something I liked, I was going to have to probably study something else or just kind of flounder. So like I said, I'd already been interested in law enforcement and more so like the forensic psychology part. I was just like, mm-hmm. you know what, let's just do something fun. Let's do something I'd like and see mm-hmm. how that works. And I took some undergrad classes at Marymount in Arlington. And one of the professors was like, he's like, stop wasting your time. He's like, just go get your graduate degree. They've got a good forensic psychology program. So that's what I did. I applied, took my GRE, and I did kind of a faster cut at my degree in a year and a half, and then that's where it started. Then the first job was basically a data analyst with the National Insurance Crime Bureau in Fairfax.
All right, but you mentioned the internship with the Office of Probation, but I see also on your resume here that you had two other internships.
Yeah, those were great. But I will say one prerequisite at Marymount is they do make sure that you have an applicable internship. Mm-hmm. And so I did one. I started with the ATF. The ATF one wasn't as hands-on. We got to see a lot of interesting things, but mm-hmm. not actually like get our hands dirty. So then I got a second one with the Arlington Police, which is just an awesome organization, really small, but super progressive. And we were put in embedded with the detectives. Mm-hmm. And we basically, as everyone knows, detectives get to everyone in the know, at least get to like 5% of cases they actually investigate. Mm-hmm. And even less than that when it's property crime. So the general staff detectives, if there were cases that they weren't going to investigate, they would basically kick them down to us to do initial research to see if anything popped out. So credit card thefts, actually that was pretty much credit card thefts or any type of like petty theft. Mm-hmm. So we would do the grunt work. We would call the credit card company, see where they use the credit card, call the place where the purse got stolen, the local bar or whatever, see if there was video, secure the video and get all that. And then if there was a little more meat on the bone, we would kick it to the detectives. So one out of every 50 of those was actually something interesting. And that actually what really piqued my interest. We got one case. My colleagues and I think there was like five or six of us that were intel. We noticed that they would steal a credit card, basically use it until it got canceled, and then ditch it. But between each stop, so they either go to Dick's or Walmart or Target, whatever, basically the big box stores, Best Buy, and just buy as much expensive stuff as they could until it got declined. But in between each stop, they would like $2 on Hertz Rent-A-Car. And we were like, what the hell is this? Like, this is the weirdest. Like, why? How do you only spend $2 at Hertz? And also what? And then it might have been one of my colleagues that actually knows, hey, aren't you also working something where they did this weird Hertz thing? And I was like, yeah. And come to find out, we realized, oh, all of these are connected. Like, what? This isn't some weird thing. Basically, the person was working with a friend at Hertz. And after they would spend a bunch of money at Best Buy, they would then call their buddy and say, hey, charge this card and see if it gets flagged. And they would charge the $2. If it didn't get flagged, then they would go to Walmart. Then they'd again call their friend. They would charge a couple bucks. And then once it got flagged, then they would ditch the card so that they weren't on camera at any of these stores. And so we were finally able to get a bunch of video of this person at all these different locations. And she finally tried to like cash a check at a bank. The bank kept her card. They did a fingerprint and I think they ended up catching her. And so that was like our one thing that we actually like solved. And it was, it was off to the races. So I was like, well, I guess this is what I want to do because I would pay you to get to do this.
But I mean, how exciting is that as an early 20-something-year-old getting that experience, getting just the scraps of cases that are left over to be able to have it turn into something like that? And I find it interesting because the person at the Hertz store is the most vulnerable in that scenario. It's kind of surprising that that person would be involved in something like that because you're generating a record when you put that $2 on there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think these were like our smartest folks around. And I didn't actually see, I think they arrested the lady. I don't know what happened to if she gave up her person at Hertz, but I had left by then. I was only there for like 4 months. So I didn't actually get to see how it turned out, but yeah, they made an arrest on her, but I don't know what happened with her co-conspirator. That would be interesting to know.
Yeah. I think it's great too, that you had three opportunities for internships. I wish the universities would help out students a little bit more with internships and give them, like you had one very early on, right?
One was in undergrad, I just knew, again, like I said, I was one of those folks that did really well in high school and then I went to college. And it just didn't click with me. So I knew if I was going to get into something, I was really going to have to show that I was a good worker and that I have this other experience. Mm-hmm. So pretty much every year I had some sort of internship or job in the summers because I needed to have that on resume to obscure the GPA.
So, as you mentioned, you get into the private sector then right out of graduate school. And these are financial crimes, so you're still using your accounting background.
Yeah, that was cool. The National Insurance Crime Bureau was really, really a good experience. I think I was there for like 2.5 years. And it more so got me into learning like how software can really help. We used i2 Analyst Notebook. So we would make these big charts for the insurance companies and usually our federal partners, usually the Secret Service for banks or FBI for like big insurance fraud cases. So that was a blast. Just putting the little pieces together. Like I enjoyed like cleaning data, which sounds insane, but like and like you're basically taking this mess and you're putting it all into something that makes sense, because a juror, they don't understand like the ins and outs of insurance and all this stuff. So if you can put it in a nice, organized, interesting format, then it's, you're going to get a lot better chance of somebody actually agreeing like, oh yes, I can follow this pattern. So no, that was great, but it was like nonprofit essentially. Mm-hmm. So they were agents and investigators, but they didn't have arrest capabilities. So basically they would do almost like privatized, do the investigations, and then hand that information over to the FBI, but also act as a conduit between the insurance companies and the feds, because most of the cases were too small to go to the feds. So you really had our agents had to like build the cases, show the one person that's done millions of dollars or the group of folks who have done the millions of dollars, as opposed to just your little one-off cases. So yeah, that was fun. But again, it was nonprofit. It wasn't the first year was great. It was more money than I never made. But then after a few years living in DC, it was not as lucrative anymore. And there's also fit. I was the youngest person there, and most of the agents were kind of retired law enforcement, so they were there up in there. So I wanted to get in a little more fast paced environment. So I jumped into more private sector after that.
It is funny, and I spent a lot of time in Baltimore, so which is obviously that far from DC, and it does seem like, I'm sure it's not just the Baltimore DC area, but I remember during my time there was a lot of folks that were double dipping, what they call double dipping. They had retired from the public sector and had basically their second career. They didn't even care if they had benefits or whatever it is, because their original job gave them benefits or whatnot. So it's funny that you mentioned that now, because that was kind of my experience too when I was in the Baltimore.
Every single person in the office, all the investigators were former, and actually from the same agency. Weird how that happened.
Just let me know when you're ready to retire, then you can come over and work with us, right?
Exactly.
So you mentioned the expense of DC, and then you take a trip cross country into Colorado.
Yeah, that was crazy. So from NICB, I then went to Fannie Mae, which was it the Federal National Mortgage Association, which is, I believe it's an NGO. Did analysis there, led a team of five folks. Became the lead analyst, but that was insane. It was 24 hours, 24/7 operation center, super high stress. And it just wasn't, I was just completely burnt out, and ended up, they eliminated a bunch of positions, one of them being mine. And I was kind of left holding the bag. Mm-hmm. And after a few months living in DC and seeing your bank account just about disappear, even though you were making good money before, was a wake up. And I was like, you know what, let's go somewhere, not for the job first. Let's go somewhere that I'll like, and then I'll find a job there. So I sold everything. If it didn't fit in my Camry, come with me. And I drove, I had a buddy in Denver, and he was like, yeah, you can crash at my place until you find a job. So I think I was 29. And yeah, so I went, but by the end of the day, I'd found, when I got there 5 days later, within 2 days, I found a job and an apartment in Longmont, Colorado, which, if you're familiar with Colorado, Denver's kind of like right there in the middle. And then a little bit north of that is Boulder, University of, what is it, CU is there?
Colorado. Yeah,
the Buffaloes. Colorado. And then there's some like little small towns around there. One of the small towns is called Longmont. And that's where I ended up. I got a bartending job, and I was like, I can live off of this, lick my wounds, and figure out what the heck I'm going to do next. So it was nice. I mean, I remember the first night I was there, I was like, what is that weird noise? And I realized it was the sound of no noise. I went from living in a basement in DC, and then now living in the middle of nowhere. Well, comparatively nowhere, in Longmont, Colorado. And it was this weird feeling. And yeah. And that's actually, I think we'll probably get into this, but to supplement my income, because again, I had quite a bit of free time since I was working evenings and weird hours, I started doing some writing to supplement my income and to keep my brain somewhat engaged, which later would come back up again late in later life. But long story short, from there, after I was there a little over a year, I was like, all right, it's time to get back in the saddle. I get another analyst job with AIG in Denver. It was a financial group, and I was doing risk and management, essentially. Another one of those things where I was there for, gosh, I think like 10 months, and they were doing massive layoffs. And I was like, I'm not doing this again. So a headhunter found me, and I switched to Charles Schwab. So I was there for a year. But again, it was one of those things where I was like, okay, this is not fun anymore. I'm driving an hour and a half. And I was like, we're just going to apply for crime analyst jobs until we get one. And I mean, I had to apply to 30 you know, and so I got the call from Portland, and yeah, and it just, I mean, I took it sight unseen. I'd never been to Portland, but people told me I would probably like it, and it ended up being my favorite city and my favorite job. But that is kind of a advice to folks out there. Like, don't be too hard on yourself if you don't get those. Like, I consider Portland our analyst group best in class. I mean, I've gone to a bunch of different cities, presented all over the place. I have not found a better group of analysts as far as professionalism and as far as just ability. And I somehow lucked my way into it. Who knows what they saw in me that maybe the other places didn't. But so that is to say, keep, just because you didn't get in some other place, who knows who's on your panel. So it was one of the things I'm very fortunate to have, yeah, tricked them into hiring me somehow. And it's been good ever since. It's the longest I've ever been with a place by a multitude of three, I think.
Yeah. No, I find it fascinating that your just philosophy of like, I'm going to go to the location, not necessarily with the job, when you first moved to Colorado. And just finding yourself there. Yeah. And as you said, you're late 20s, early 30s. And I think we get so impatient in our 20s. Like, we feel that we should be several steps ahead of where we really are. And I think a lot of us are like that. And so, to your point, you kind of get down at yourself. You don't get certain jobs. And the idea of feeling like a failure and all this, but there's this path that you found as you kept going. You kept chugging away, finding different opportunities, and then you said, hey, I'm just going to apply until you find analysis job.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, you got to go backwards to go forwards. I think a lot of people get hung up on that. Okay, well, my next job, I have to be making more money, or I have to have at least a newer job title, or like advanced job title. And I don't know, maybe in some industries that may be the case, but in my instance, I think if, as long as you can get your foot in the door and you can explain, hey, this is why I did go back. Because I think that first job, they were probably like, why did this dude not work for 6 months? And then he was slinging margaritas for a year. Like, what? But I got the interview and I explained it to him. You know, you just be honest. And I was like, hey, I did this because I was tired of DC. I really liked this area. And then they're like, oh yeah, this person's going to stay. Because you may look at that and be like, hey, he's zipping all around in the country, he's not going to stay here. But I was like, no, I want to stay here. And I'm being picky about the places that I do now. And I'm interested in this. So I think as long as you can make a case, that's helpful. Because I think people appreciate when you're genuine. And if they don't appreciate that, then don't freaking work there. Like that's the, people will get sad about, oh, well, I didn't get that job. It's like, well, maybe you wouldn't have been a good fit. Like, I'm certain, like, I think I did really well at Fannie Mae. I was a good worker. I rose through the ranks, but it was not a fun place to be. And it was a blessing that happened, because it was not a good fit. Like and that doesn't mean if you don't fit, you're a bad person. It just means that that's a different group. Just like when you're in school, you're in certain cliques, for better or worse. It's whether you're on a sports team or you're in some, the AV club, whatever it may be, you know, you find your clan eventually. And I think it's kind of like, you know, when you do your extracurriculars and you're in some specialty group, whether it's knitting or bird watching or whatever, you tend to find that the people in those groups also do the other stuff that you like. Whatever that may be, there's a lot of crossover. That Venn diagram starts to get a lot closer. So I think if you can express that in these things and do things, gravitate to things you like, then it's going to serve you better in the long run.
Yeah, you mentioned it, but I'm curious if you have any ideas. So you walk into the interview with Portland Police Bureau, and obviously the interview must have went well because you got hired, but I'm just wondering, is there anything that you think you brought to the table, or something that they were looking for that you fit well in that scenario?
I think for me, and again, this, it's always situational, right? Like, my team recently we had a fellow leave who was awesome at SQL, and he did all of our database stuff. Well, when he left, that was a huge hole. So who do you think we're going to hire? We're going to hire somebody that has SQL. Like, you might be the best investigative analyst out there. You can do all these other different things, but if you don't know SQL, we're not going to look at you, right? So I think part of it was opportunity meets preparation. They had just gotten set up with Tableau, They were pretty early in it, and I had just used quite a bit of Tableau at my last job in the Denver area at Charles Schwab, and I was able to present that proficiency. But more importantly, I think it was more just, hey, I've done these. Someone's like, oh, what software should I learn? I'm like, well, you know what? Learn a whole bunch, because you're always going to have to relearn something. But as long as you can show that you are proficient at picking new things up, then you're fine. And that's what I said to them. I was like, look, I'd never used it before I went to Schwab. And I was pretty much self-taught, except for one guy gave me some tips and tricks. And before that, I'd never used SQL before. But some folks helped me get up to speed when I was in ICB. So that's kind of what I said. It's like, look, there's never been a software where I was completely lost. I can be flexible, but I am very proficient in this one. So I think being able to cite examples of things that you've used in the past and how you can apply that. Because I think people definitely look more for the long term than, all right, well, this person can learn this really quick, but what's their growth potential versus somebody that can learn? Because I mean, I'm sure some of these softwares are going to be obsolete in a few years, and we're going to have to relearn other stuff. So also, just again, I knew, because I had been rejected so much, that I was like, you know what, stop trying to think what they want to hear and just be honest with them. Be like, this is what I like, this is what I don't like, this is why I want to do this, this is why I don't want to do other things. And I think that came off in that interview. I think I was myself, and I am a good fit with this team, or at least I think so. Yeah. I really like everyone on my team. There's literally not a person that I dislike, both professionally and just as a human. And I've never had that anywhere else. So giving those managers a peek into who you are as a person is helpful, because then they can help identify, oh yeah, this person would be good for my team. So not taking it personally when you don't get in those, again, just kind of follows that theme.
Yeah. Well, I can even see, I'm putting myself in your situation, and I was there years before, is when I'm in interviews and I'm nervous and okay, what's the right answer? And I'm more worried about...
Yeah, you see the nervous person every time. You can always pick them out.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's there's something to that, where you came in and just were authentic, and that wasn't trying to pull one over on them, so to speak.
And I didn't even have the opportunity to be inauthentic. And I think this helped me. I was actually on a road trip, and I was in a different time zone, and I can't wait for my managers to hear this. I don't know if I've told them. I think I messed up the date on when I was going to get interviewed and what time, because the time zone was also jacked up. And I was literally walking my dog when I got a call. And again, it was like a weird phone number. It was, you know, it was like 503, which is the Portland area code. And I was like, whatever, I'm just walking the dog, I'll answer it. And it was like, oh, hi, this is Captain, you know, so with Portland Police. Are you ready? And I was like, oh, shoot. I was so caught off guard. I was literally walking my dog. I was in a park. I think it was in Salt Lake City. And she almost certainly like had to go to the bathroom while I was on the call. So I'm like handling dog stuff while I'm doing it. And it's just, but I've never been more calm, and it just more like, hey, it was a conversation. And that's how I think you want to obviously prep. There's certain things that you should do, but yeah, being yourself and being calm really does help.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So obviously the dog was quiet for you, at least.
Oh yeah. She's great. She's yeah.
All
yeah.
right. So you get in the door, you're at the bureau. What are you getting into then? You talked about Tableau, but what are the problems you're trying to solve here?
A lot of it was automation. I think just figuring like how can we utilize this new tool to its greatest extent? How can we kind of make templates for the things that we're doing and just kind of leverage all of this to the best ability? And one of the first things I worked on was we're still under the DOJ for that, our inspector general oversees for use of force. Mm-hmm. So a lot of guardrails around that. And although my team doesn't do that, we have an inspector general. One of the first things that I built was a dashboard for a public dashboard for use of force. And that was something that we took a bunch of data from a bunch of different disparate data sources. They kind of had to scramble to put something together. I think they were using like a survey tool to collect data at first. Obviously, they're not doing that anymore, but that was pulling from something and creating an Excel file, just all these different crazy things. Mm-hmm. So able to leverage the Tableau to connect all those disparate data sources, but then present it in like an easy way or an easy manner. And that was kind of something that I hung my hat on in the beginning. Created this thing and put it on the page. It's still on our public website. Now the use of force team, their analysts oversee that. But I kind of kicked that off. And then that's what I think at least our team realized, like, oh, this is, we can now apply this sort of stuff for a lot of other things. A majority of those now are internal, but we also expanded our open data resources as well.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, how did you evaluate success in that project? Because you're dealing with the public, so you're building this for the public. And normally, analysts, when they build something, the client's usually somebody within, police chief, detective, you can just go talk to them. But in terms of this situation, you're publishing this to out there to the public.
So two really good, easy pieces of feedback. One, we deal with all the public records requests, or at least for data. So based off of those requests, we can kind of craft something. So if we get 100 requests on what is the race of individuals who are involved in a use of force incident, and that's our biggest one, obviously we're going to highlight that so that we have a page that, you know, you can filter on use on race, or we have graphs and a lot of different color code stuff. And then so it kind of evolved from there. So you have that, and then you have the types of force, and then people want to know, oh, well, how much force is actually being used? So put out statistics on, actually, it's a very small percentage of arrests even involve use of force. I mean, it's a very like 5%, something like that. And then so how many calls actually result in arrest, even smaller. So it's like less than a half a percentage point or something like that. So because people, they want the data to, they want to download the data so that they can figure out like, oh, how much, like, are we using too much or whatever it is. So trying to answer some of those things in basically like infographic form, but then also making it interactive so that people can try to figure it out on their own. So again, you know, whether someone was undergoing a mental health crisis or they were under the influence, we made sure and put those on there too. So using the stuff that we got from the requests is like a template. And then of course, the DOJ and the judge in Portland who oversees it, obviously they have to okay these things. So if they don't like something or they think we need more, then they let us know. But that hasn't really been the case. I think that original design worked. And then obviously the analysts that have taken that over are doing a good job of continuing that.
All right. That's fascinating. How far back does it go?
So it's all of our stuff. So I will say one thing that's kind of a good plug is all of on the our website, so portlandoregon.gov/police, we have all of our open data. We have an open data portal. Mm-hmm. And we actually, I don't know if you're familiar, are you familiar with the Vera Institute of Justice?
Yes.
So they put out a transparency index. Mm-hmm. And this past year, we just got ranked second in the country for most transparent bureau. Right behind our Seattle, which is like our little friendly rivalry. We'll overtake them next
year. You'll get them. Yeah.
But that's cool because we really do, like, it's a nice little competitive thing. But so we have all of our stuff in interactive or downloadable form on that. So I'm actually going to I'm clicking on it now. I'm curious. I want to say 2017. I could be wrong though, because I know the. Yeah, 2017, Q3 of 2017, and then it's updated every quarter. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the beauties about working with Tableau is that you have it in graphical form. It's actually, you see, it allows to get multiple resources to be brought in on the back end, but it also gives the end user the ability to get to a more granular level of how these particular summaries are calculated.
It's a super powerful tool. I'm definitely an advocate for it on Tableau stand. I'm actually speaking, I'm sure this podcast will come out after, but next week I'm speaking at on a Tableau webinar series. They're doing a Tableau and public safety sector, and I'm presenting to that for folks within the country that are interested in using it for those sorts of things. So I'm going to cover some topics in that. We couldn't do the things that we want to do without it, and I've yet to find anything that comes anywhere close to matching its ability to customize, as well as do things sharing with the public, as well as make our internal stuff more efficient.
Very good. And then, and also just to finish up with the transparency idea, I see that you did present on transparency and open data in 2021 at IACP.
That's true, I did. That was, yeah, IACP, we talked about basically data best practices, went through our process of how we publish open data, mm-hmm. the considerations that we go through, the things that you need to think about for accessibility, and then how you set it up, how you set up your raw data for download. So that was a good one. And then we're vindicated maybe by getting that second highest rating by Vera. So yeah.
Now, do you feel with that rating from Vera that you in Seattle, Portland and Seattle, are doing anything that dramatically different, that it's just unique to those departments and that other departments around the country would have difficulty coming up to doing some of the stuff that you've done?
I don't think so, because it's more just the scope, the amount of stuff that we put out there. So you know, they rank you on certain things. I mean, there's one thing that we're not published, that we don't get a good rating on. Mm-hmm. So no, it's about these bureaus having they just have to do it, honestly. Mm-hmm. And in my presentation that I did for IACP, I wasn't like, well, you got to have Tableau or you got to have whatever to do this. Mm-hmm. No, it was more, these are kind of the general practices that we do in order to, I don't know, make these things make sense or have them as readily available to the public. I mean, even if it's as easy as putting out a downloadable Excel spreadsheet, mm-hmm. so at least you're putting the raw data out there. All of ours come with the raw data that you can mm-hmm. download, or at least most of it does. Tableau just allows us to kind of limit those public records requests, because rather than somebody being like, all right, let me download the raw data and figure out what the percentage of calls are that result in custodies and then what percentage of those result in use of force, they've got that, the infographic is right there. So that's easy for media outlets and whatever to just do a screen grab. But for the more academic folks, mm-hmm. or for even Vera, you get ranked, I think, on like, there's like little weights for certain aspects. So like you might not get a high rating on, let's say, the interactive dashboard, but the biggest weights are the ones just putting it out there. So no, I think other folks, what, you know, I would suggest is look at the ones that are higher rated, see what they're doing, and yeah, try to copy that as much as possible. I mean, like I said, the one area that we don't have the highest ranking in, I'm looking at the other bureaus and what they put out there, and that'll be mm-hmm. potentially our template for improving that last piece that we don't have in there.
Well, that's interesting. So, I mean, this is where it would be beneficial if there wasn't 17,000 police departments in this country, and that you could have like one standard on what information would be made available to the public.
Yeah. And I think that's why, I mean, I guess in theory, that's what the UCR stats are. Obviously, those are very surface level mm-hmm. and it takes them a year to actually publish them. But they do have, I think they've got a new tool. It's called like UCR Explorer or something. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, that is a little better. But you're mm-hmm. right, from a very granular data, it's everybody's got a different thing, just like filing your taxes. Like most mm-hmm. people use one particular thing, but there's a million different things of software you can use. So yeah, it's I think we're a ways away from that from that happening.
Hi, I'm Jawang. I'm a crime analyst with the Saskatoon Police Service. The public service announcement that I have is especially for junior analysts, but also senior analysts, just be true to yourself and recognize that the police culture that you're in shouldn't necessarily shape who you are, but you have something to bring towards your service as a benefit as well.
Hey, this is Shauna Gibson from the Pacific Northwest. This is to all you crazy PEMCO drivers out there. Do you know what a zipper merge is? It is when you let somebody else get in front of you and then somebody comes in behind you. You really don't have to push everybody out. So may you all learn the zipper merge, and may the 405 and I-5 be a little bit more pleasant to drive down. Good luck with that, all of you crazy drivers.
So let's talk a little bit more about automation then, because you went through this project here that we just described, but overall, that during your work here in Portland, it's been a lot of automation.
Yeah, a couple things that really, another thing I can kind of hang my hat on is we put together a patrol activity dashboard that we put out for sergeants. We had a request. Our supervisor at the time was very much interested in how can we make our patrol folks more efficient and how can I identify how they're efficient. Mm-hmm. So we worked with a bunch of different sergeants, and I think we went to one precinct and we were like, how do you evaluate whether someone's good at their job? Mm-hmm. Of course, there's a bunch of different answers. Obviously, some of it is not captured in data, which was fine. Mm-hmm. But really, the focus was like, oh, how many calls are they taking? And I was like, okay, let's start there. So we can see how many calls somebody's taken on average. Oh, well, it depends on what shift they're on, because obviously you're going to get more calls at night. Okay, so let's add that contextual layer in there. Oh, well, you may take a bunch of calls, but you're last on scene, first to leave. Okay, so let's look at that next. Let's bring that layer in. And what ended up happening is we kept bringing in layer after layer after layer. And so we're pulling from call data, we're pulling from offense data, then arrest. It's like, okay, well, you wrote a bunch of reports, but you never arrest anybody. So how efficient, like, are you just, you're just writing these reports and you're actually doing anything through it? So we ended up having this thing that pulls in, I think maybe like 8 different data sources. And I got really inspired. Again, there's the Tableau Viz of the Day that has a bunch of interesting visuals out there. Mm-hmm. But what the best ones are usually from the world of sports, because there's free data out there. And a lot of the websites, if you do like fantasy sports, they want to give you cool visuals so that you join that group, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the best one, I went to a bunch of different sports sites, and the one that was the most compelling, in my opinion, was the PGA Tour, because they also were evaluating them on a one-person basis. They're not looking at an entire team. You are that team. And they had all these really cool comparative stats. And I was like, oh, that would be great. It's basically like a baseball card, but for this one person. Mm-hmm. And that's how I modeled it. So ended up basically automating how we collect that data. It's all CAD and general offense stuff. So it's all in there. We basically made this with one of my colleagues, made this dashboard that updates on a monthly basis. And in theory, it can be used by sergeants when they do their performance review. So they can see, all right, not just, okay, you took 6.5 calls or whatever for the year on every shift, but where you fell within the span of the bureau, but also the precinct and the precinct shift. So it shows whether you're in the bottom 10%, the middle 50%, or the top 30%, whatever. So yeah, that was something that we rolled out. And that, I mean, that took about a year to make, just because we wanted to make sure that we had all those caveats. So, you know, we'd put something out and then someone would use it and they're like, oh, but what about the person that doesn't make it to, you know, gets a bunch of calls, but doesn't make it there because they get called off. All right. So we add that other piece in there, but each layer only made it, you know, better and better. And I think it also does a service to the officers. So, you know, some folks were like, oh, well, this person, they don't take as many calls as everyone else. And we look at them like, yeah, you're right. However, they're also writing way more reports. This is a much more efficient person. And it's really, it takes a holistic look at an officer, because not every person is the same. It's like, to use a 90s basketball metaphor, which are the best, I think. You look at the Bulls, like they didn't have a bunch of superstars and that middle team. Yeah, they had one guy that did everything. But then you had the sharpshooter on the outside. You had Kerr. Then you had the person that was just hitting the boards. So you need all those, just like any other thing, you need all those different people. So you need the person that's going to shag the calls. They're taking all those unwanted things off the board. But then you also need the person that's really doing the investigative work. They're maybe doing more traffic stops, some the things that are more proactive. And you kind of have that mix of people. But the person who is taking way more calls is probably writing less reports, and the person that's writing more reports and doing arrests is probably taking less calls. So you can see all of it together to really evaluate how this person is doing.
Yeah. So what was the patrol's response to this as it gets implemented and you go in year or more after implementation? Did they start? You talked about it being the baseball cards. I know. Yeah. I know. Like athletes are super sensitive about their stats.
Yeah. To be honest, and this is one thing that I feel like we haven't gotten a ton of feedback from the field. I thought we would more officers would be interested. I thought they would think it would be fun. Mm-hmm. We offer it to them if they want a PDF printout. We can do that. I think that's one of the struggles that you have. Obviously you can tell that I'm excited about it. I think it's very worthwhile, mm-hmm. but it had a bit of a lukewarm response, but and that's not a knock against the folks who weren't that excited about it. It's more this isn't what they're used to. Mm-hmm. So we got to figure out like what is it that maybe makes it less, you know, engaging or useful than other things. And people do say, and they're right, and they're like, oh, well, stats don't tell the whole story. And I agree. I'm like, yeah, you're right. It doesn't. If you only relied on this to tell whether somebody's a good officer, mm-hmm. you're not doing a good job of evaluating that person. Mm-hmm. But I think folks are just so used to evaluating people based off of these other things that they've been doing for years that it's a bigger climb to actually look at it. So we do more tailored training and that sort of thing to see if those are things. So some people really like it. Some people mm-hmm. just don't care. And there's a lot of people that are like right in the middle. So yeah, it just kind of depends on you as a supervisor. But I will say one of the things that we do is new sergeants training every year. We started doing that 3 years ago, and the new sergeants coming along are much more, I guess, savvy with these sorts of things, or just more receptive because they've been using apps and those sorts of things to make decisions their whole lives now at this point. So
sure.
More comfortable with these sorts of things. So it's something that we see kind of growing with each group.
Yeah. So if you do a survey, I want you to add a golfing question to see if more are playing golf since you tailored it from the PGA site.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I would have thought that maybe they would be more engaged too, but with what you talked about in terms of their role and what type of activity they're getting in, maybe there's the data's not suggesting to them how they do improve.
Well, I mean, also, I think it's to be honest, I think most people are just, they are doing a good job, and they're, especially with our staffing shortages, there's people or they're going call to call to call to call. So like, they're mm-hmm. just like, hey, I'm doing everything I can. It doesn't really matter. Like, I know that my stuff or whatever is good. So I think that's part of it too. Like, it's like if you're running 100 miles an hour all the time, mm-hmm. you don't really care about looking to see that, oh yeah, yeah, of course, I know I go to like thousands of calls every month. So I think that's part of it too. So I think if once things kind of get more, hopefully get into a more, I guess, a pattern that isn't mm-hmm. so just running and gunning all the time, mm-hmm. then that might be something that's more, I don't know, that people are would be more interested in utilizing to see how they can be more efficient because they actually have time. But right now I don't think they have time to even bother with it because they're just so inundated with calls.
All right. Let's get into more of a discussion on strategic analysis now, because that's, I think, something you also get into beyond the automation. We've talked about it a little bit on this show, but I'm always curious to know more about strategic analysis.
Yeah, I think I think of it more like kind of like data driven decision making. So like mm-hmm. we're like you alluded to, like I'm not an investigative analyst. I'm not embedded with detectives. We're not really doing casework. Mm-hmm. We're doing more things that have to do with policy or things looking at trends. So a good example would be the latest chief he instituted really wanted to get more visual contact with the public. So we did a bunch of walking beats over the holidays mm-hmm. and to some extent still continuing some of that, and really wanted to see where should we go? Not just where are the high calls, but where are the areas that have like high foot traffic? So we can actually, hey, look, we're here. We care. We're on foot. We want to know what people's issues are. And so part of it is identifying one. Okay. We're obviously not just going to go to the middle of nowhere. So looking at the calls, but then also seeing foot traffic. So we did some geography analysis of looking at like foot traffic. So where were our subway stops or where were our bus stops? And also looking at schedules of how many people actually are on it. So if we know there's a particular hub, we put more
officers up there, they went up there more often. So a blend of, all right, we're going to try to go to where there's high crime areas, but also where there's more people, just so the folks that they're interacting with kind of actually get a visual of the cops are here and they care. And then they also, with that, we continue to, my supervisor helped them build some stuff around like community engagement. So if they did, say, talk to a business owner, not just, okay, responded to a call, tracking that too, so we can at least strategically say, okay, look, we're with this group, or we're talking to these business owners, and these are the things that we're doing outside of just regular law and order type things. So like you said, being a little more strategic in our response, not just having a knee-jerk reaction, like being a little bit more proactive. So that's something that those are the types of things that we're also assisting with.
Yeah, I really like the fact that you seem to always be looking for new data sets and not just trying to use the standard data sets that you hear from a lot from police departments. It seems like you're looking, taking that extra step, getting a little bit more extra.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it. I think people think that, like, oh, well, you've got access to everything. Well, I mean, if you've ever actually looked at report data or whatever, it's never 100% all the way there. Like, maybe someone did, and that's not a knock on the officers, but it's just the matter of, like, how much time in a day do you have? And are you going to spend most of that, you know, writing a super detailed report, or are you going to respond to the person that's getting burglarized right now, right? So there's that give and take. So we have to find unique ways to fill in those gaps. And the same thing with, I haven't been doing a lot of it, but my colleagues looking at the response to, like, the fentanyl and opioid crisis, like, what are a call may be coded as a welfare check or whatever, but we know that a certain portion of those are probably actual, like, the person's overdosing or whatever. So how do we, how do we quantify those things? So we're very much used to trying to see in between the lines and put these data sets together that maybe don't explicitly exist.
Yeah. I also like too, that it sounds like it's a lot of problem solving. You're taking the data, you're making the decision, like you mentioned. But when some folks hear strategic analysis, they hear threat assessments. And some of those threat assessments reports are very, I don't know, they're very bland. They're not really getting into the weeds, so to speak. They're, you know, crying. If they give any kind of prediction, it's usually very safe and what they're predicting. And so, but I like, from your standpoint, you're taking the data, it is strategic analysis, but there is a mark that you're trying to make.
Sure. Yeah. And that's, I've never done a threat assessment. So that's a different group. That's our folks that do that, our criminal intelligence. But yeah, like I said, we're trying to make, what are the best decisions that we can help based off of, like, evidence. It drives me nuts when I hear someone say, like, oh, well, based off of our population, this is how many cops we need. Well, guess what? We have an identical population to Baltimore. If you think Portland and Baltimore have the same problems, like, that's ridiculous. You know, that's not to say one's worse or better, but we have very different problems. We have a different geography. We have a different focus on whether it's property crimes. I think off my top of my head, I think maybe we have more property crimes than they have way more person crimes. That's a very different response, right? Mm-hmm. And to say that each of those places should have an identical force is ridiculous, you know? So you should rely on, okay, how many calls are actually coming in? And what is how do you weight those calls? How many people are actually going to them? You know, do they have a thing that says, hey, you have to have 3 units on a high priority call? Ours is a priority call, has to have at least 2 units. Well, how many people are in that unit? Is everyone a 2-person car? Is it a 1-person? Like, there's just so many different layers. So these things where you just say, well, because of this, these kind of, like, we don't have the budget these days, or no one does, to just do rule of thumb stuff anymore. So the days of saying, well, for a city this size, you got to have that or over, and thinking more strategic and more looking at the actual specifics. So we have it available. We've got that data available. We can see exactly how many people respond. We can see how long they're actually on the call. We can put some really specific figures around that, which is more efficient, and it's more cost effective. So obviously there's human element parts that you have to consider, but at the end of the day, being going off of like true facts as opposed to just someone's gut reaction is just always, to me, makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Now you have 9 analysts in your unit. Do you have a dedicated IT personnel?
Oh, we do. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, technically they work for the city, the technology bureau, but we do have IT folks that are embedded with police. Yeah. And we work great with them. They're awesome. I just got off the phone with one of them who builds the applications. Just absolutely phenomenal. Like there's never been something that he couldn't do. Always surprises me. And, you know, I like to think we have a good working relationship with them because we're dependent on them to, like you said, they build the structures behind the scenes and then that we use to query. So yeah, we do. And that's super important. And I know not everybody has that luxury.
Yeah, no, I think that was one of the struggles I had when I was an analyst. We had maybe some good ideas. We had certain deficiencies in the data, but I know my IT abilities were limited. Yeah. And trying to get a dedicated IT member to work certain projects was problematic.
Yeah. And we still, sometimes you got to get in line. We could definitely use more of them. Yeah. I always say that anytime I talk to any supervisor, anybody who's above my pay grade, I'm like, hey, I know we need more officers, but like get 2 more Eds. Yeah. Who's that? Like that would be huge. Mm-hmm. You know, especially the force multiplier of work that we can get done with really good folks like that is hard to quantify.
Yeah. So what do you think's next for your unit?
I think now that we have been building out our data capabilities as far as like reporting, we're starting to get more hyper-specific, I would say. So we started out with dashboards and that sort of stuff that were like, okay, here's the areas if you want to dig into where calls are happening time of day. But now we're getting more hyper-specific for specialty units. Like I worked with the air support unit on getting basically they built an app, and then that app, in conjunction with our record management system, we can really look at a whole host of data on how their involvement affects day-to-day activity and patrol activity. So we're working more with those specialty units now on so we can evaluate the impact and see if we can find more efficiencies and be better at reporting. Yeah, so really taking, like I said, going to that big picture and then being more hyper-specific in the stuff that we can help folks with.
All right, good. And your unit, is all of them work from home?
Yeah, we currently all work from home. Starting at the beginning of the pandemic, we started working from home. And I think we just found that, one, people prefer it. It's just from a quality of life standpoint. I get to exercise more. I eat better, like everything, which makes me a better employee. And I'm probably more efficient. I'm kind of a social person, so I'm not as distracted. I can still bug people on Teams and Zoom and stuff. But yeah, I've seen us really like, and I think we've shown that in our work product.
Yeah. So I guess, how did that come about in terms of you got your group continuing to be work from home? Because I think a lot of analysts around the country, some of them never worked from home even during the pandemic, and then some quickly, as soon as they could get them back, they were back at the office. So I'm curious to get an understanding of what the conversation was like. What were some of the hurdles that you guys had to overcome?
Well, that's probably a little bit above my pay grade. Yeah. My supervisor is the one that did that, but my guess is it's more, again, because when, you know, some folks have asked, like, oh, well, how do you know you're not just messing around? It's like, well, because you look at our work. Like, we have just as many requests, if not more, coming in than we did 3 years ago, and we're still meeting those in a timely manner. Like, there's no way I could do that stuff if we were all jerking around or whatever. But I mean, if you look at it, none of the cops work in office, right? Like, and you can see their work product. Someone isn't constantly watching them, right? I mean, obviously, there's more of a record of what they're doing, of course. But you just have to look at the work product, and you can tell. And if someone isn't, I mean, my bosses always know what I'm doing because my little green light on Teams is on. And if you're not, it's yellow, right? There's no getting around that. So that has never really been an issue, at least on our team, at least from what I've seen. And I think maybe it's probably tough because obviously some parts of the city, they do go back. But mm-hmm. again, it also speaks to the professionalism of my team. Mm-hmm. I've never worked with a group of more professional, but also just like people that care mm-hmm. About what they do within my unit. So I would literally trust any of these folks. I could just give them my project that I started working on and they could pick it up. And I hope they feel the same way about me. So there's our collaboration is so tight and strong. There's no competition that it also makes those things easier and makes us more trustworthy to do these, the work from home stuff.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm glad that you don't have some like wild dashboard that calculates the amount of time that you're in green versus yellow.
Right, exactly. I do sometimes I see that it's like I know I'm working but it shows yellow, so yeah, I guess it calculates the time that you're doing it, but yeah, totally.
yeah, so you're in a situation, well, let me ask this instead of assuming it. So is there a requirement that they said that, hey, you can work from home, but you have to live within so many miles of the city because we may have to call you in?
Yes. In fact, we had a guy on our team and he for family reasons moved to the other side of the country, and that was kind of that. he couldn't do it anymore. And then there was even some, not within our bureau, but other bureaus, there was some folks living out of state and they cracked down on that. So basically, I think it's the understanding that basically, hey, if we have something and we need you to come in either later in the day or tomorrow or whatever, like that's kind of the rubric, because there's some folks that may live an hour and a half away from the office, but it's on them to be there. So I guess in theory, you could live, I don't know, in Hawaii or something, but you'd have to have the ability to get a private plane and be at work by the end of the day. So, but I think it's with that understanding that if you need to be in the office or you need to attend something basically day of, You that's this thing. So my team, we live with, I mean, everyone I know lives within 45 minutes of the actual place. But yeah, I live in the city.
Yeah, because I would just see that would be an advantage from time to time coming in. You're starting a new project. You just mentioned what's next in terms of getting more granular with your projects. There's certainly going to be an advantage going in there and doing the classic board meeting.
Yeah, and we still do that, like training. We go in for when we're giving training. I mean, I went down to an hour and a half south of here for a retail theft meeting. So yeah, it's still when we find it conducive to that, but it also, the working from home also makes it so that we can do, we can be a little bit more flexible in being at a couple places at the same time. I mean, I had four meetings today, and if I was downtown, I think it would have been more difficult. And I'm not talking and annoying all the other analysts. They're probably tired of hearing me yabber on about whatever. So I think it is much more conducive to working with a bunch of different groups since our group is centralized.
All right. Let's get on to some advice for our listeners. And in particular, you mentioned it before, you do freelance writing and you've been a writer since your Colorado days. And
yeah,
that's something for me is near and dear to my heart, because I do think that overall law enforcement analysts lack writing, and I'm in that boat. So I'm not throwing stones in a glass house. So I'm just kind of curious your take on writing and certainly any advice that you would have for our listeners.
Yeah, I was super lucky that that was always hammered into me when I was younger, whether it's in school or home, like just like have a good grasp of that. Just like someone that has a good grasp of math skills, they can't just use a calculator or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I luckily took a bunch of for fun, I took English classes when I was in college, and I knew I was a fairly solid writer. And like I said, to supplement my income, I did some writing for some local newspapers in Colorado. They just put out open invites, and luckily I was able to do that. Then I wrote for a magazine for a while in Colorado, and now I just do freelance stuff more so on my non-work time. Related to my hobbies, and that, I don't know, it kind of keeps you a little sharper on your toes, I think. And I'm definitely more
a little more critical of folks' writing when I see at this level. But yeah, it's something that I think is super important. And when you talk about interviewing for jobs, yeah, everybody knows how to do a freaking pivot table and do this research. But hey, if you have this one little extra thing, like, yeah, I also know how to write. That's just one more little leg up that you have with folks.
Yeah. So how about tips? Maybe even if it's just specific to the law enforcement realm, what would you like to see more analysts do in terms of writing? Or is there a typical mistake that maybe you see over and over and over again?
Maybe not necessarily. Gosh, I mean, it's so hard because I almost feel like I can't imagine trying to get better at it at this stage in the game. Like, you're either like, you know how to do it or you don't. But I mean, really, practice is the only way. Like, so I try to record everything like we do. I'm doing more long-term research these days, and I really try to put it in a narrative format and do read a lot of studies that are out there. So a good portion of my day is reading research studies. So look how people are writing these things. If you're not a reader, you're not going to be a good writer. So that's part of it. I know folks that are just like never read anything, whether it's books or research reports or anything, and they're not good writers. So you learn by, none of us just learn in a vacuum. So basically copying, you picking that up is I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. All right, good. And so now we're going to move on to personal interest then. And you just mentioned it, your hobbies. So
yeah,
you are a nationally ranked beer judge.
That is a true fact.
So not only are you a good writer, you must have some kind of good palate as well.
Well, I can memorize a bunch of terms really well. Yeah, that's kind of a weird thing. I got into home brewing, gosh, maybe almost 15 years ago. One of my buddies, he had done some in Colorado. It's pretty, if you live in the Boulder area, it's pretty much obligatory. He then got one of my other friends into it, and then he invited me over one day, and it was kind of hit the ground running. It was kind of like science meets art. And it was one of those things that just captivated me, and we brewed all the time together, and I've continued to do it to this day. But the more you get into that world, there's all these little sub worlds of that. And part of it is there's this thing called the Beer Judge Certification Program. It's kind of like, honestly, the best way to describe it is like the AKC. You see those judges at the Westminster Dog Show. They're looking at like the dog's tail and the spots and all this stuff. It's the exact same thing. It's not, oh, is this beer better than this one? How close does it fit to this style? It's literally a dog show. Now, obviously, if you make a bad one, it's not going to fit those styles. And the styles exist because they've been around for hundreds of years or whatever, and people like them. So yeah, that's, and there's multi-stages to it. Part of it is you do an online exam, and then there is a tasting one. So they evaluate how well you tasted against judges who have already met that standard. And then the final one is a written test that I actually went to San Diego and took on the history, and then as well as all the style. I think there's about 120 different recognized styles that you get quizzed on, and it's a written test, all free written. And I recently passed that, so that I'm at the second highest level. The next would be a master judge, so maybe one day. But yeah, I'm currently at the national rank.
That is very interesting. Congratulations.
So my freelance writing, I write for homebrew magazines, travel magazines, and I actually did in work, I got written with a colleague in an air support magazine for law enforcement called Airbeat. So yeah, it all blends together.
Oh man, yeah. So do you know Julie Wartell?
No, is she in California?
She is in California.
I think my boss knows her, and I think I think she does a similar thing if it's the same person.
So I don't think she brews, but she likes beer, and she has done like mappings, and I think they've even done studies on not bars, but more like craft beers, like the craft beer establishments and how they impact neighborhoods.
Yeah, and in my spare time, I of course I have to do analysis like on the weekends, yeah. Otherwise my brain freaks out. So I've done some dashboards with beer related stuff on my personal website. So those things inform each other. I learn things in that I can apply. Oh, let me do these interesting graphics at work now. Or, oh, I learned this like little technique for calculations. I can apply that in my other life. So even though those things don't cross over during the day, they definitely like your interests definitely help bolster those skills for sure.
So are you going to be eventually judging a beer competition?
Oh, I've done mm-hmm. dozens already. To progress the ranks, you get experience points.
Okay.
And so you have to have a certain amount of points in order to judge. Pretty much anyone can actually judge, but mm-hmm. to move up through the ranks, you have to meet those experience points plus pass the test. And actually recently I just went down to a professional competition, the Best of Craft Beer Awards down in Bend, Oregon. So yeah, I do mostly homebrew competitions because there's more of them, but there's other ones like the National Homebrew Competition. There's Great American Beer Festival. So I'm sure now that I'm at this rank, I'll be doing some more of the professional stuff.
All right. Very good. I mean, I might be able to do that, but I have not tasted an IPA that I found enjoyable yet. So I think I would be in trouble.
I say that it's like food. Some folks say like, oh, I don't like beer or whatever. I'm like, well, that's like saying you don't like food. There's got to be a style out there for you. So yeah, I'm sure I could find something that you would.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like some beers, just not IPA.
Yeah.
All right. And you mentioned food. I do want to also, you have a club on fermented food, right? In Portland.
Yeah. Cause I don't have enough hobbies. I recently started the Portland Rot Club with a friend and we meet once a month and we everything from tempeh to kombucha to anything that the controlled rot we get our hands into. Yeah.
Oh man, you're just going to have a whole meal. You're just going to have your beer, you're going to have your food, and yes.
More beer, sauerkraut on bread. Yeah, there you go. That's all of those are ferment, so.
Oh man, very good. All right, Cody, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. This is where you can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
This is more for the folks that are in the government sector. One thing I like try to keep in mind for myself when I'm thinking about what I'm doing or when I'm producing something, at the end of the day, you're a public servant. It's a little cliche, but you do work for the people. So think about what's best for the public. So whether that's open data reports that you're doing internally, but they're going to use in a public forum, or when you're working with another analyst, like you're not trying to one-up them. You're trying to get to the best product so that you're benefiting your work. So every day I think like maybe one day I'm not as engaged as I could be. I'm like, hey, literally my neighbor is paying my salary as we speak. So think about that when you're thinking about, oh, how should we do this? Or how should we publish this report? Or how should we craft it? How should we say it? Think what's in the public interest. And that usually guides you in the best way. So that's something that I always try to keep in mind. Anytime I'm either frustrated or something I'm excited about or whatever, it's that kind of keeps me grounded. So always remember that you're at the end of the day, you're a public servant. So act accordingly.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Cool.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Cody.
Thank yeah, man. Thanks for having
so
me.
So much. And you be safe.
All right. You too, bud.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.